This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, we talk with an IT professional about the latest on the SolarWinds cyber attack. But we are going to start with being a medic in a war zone. Bill Strasinski is the author of a new memoir, Care Under Fire, about his time as a medic during the Vietnam War. He visits with John Harris, host of the Prairie Pulse television show.
Tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. I went into the Army in 1967. I'm a graduate of Mankato State College. And I live currently in Scandia, Minnesota, with my wife, Kirsten. I've devoted my career since I got out of the military and out of college to public policy development and represent a lot of people's interests at the Minnesota legislature, actually. And I've been doing that for almost 50 years.
Yeah, you have. Full disclosure, of course, you do a lot of work for Minnesota Public Television Group, just for full disclosure there. You've done a lot of work in state government, but today we're here to talk about the book, Care Under Fire. Bill, why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote this book because I've always felt there was a need to tell the story that politicians need to understand the impact war has on individuals and on families and the impact of their decisions. Ken Burns went into that quite a bit in his series recently, but I've always felt that soldiers will always do the job that they're called upon to do, even if it's a difficult situation. But I want politicians to understand the full ramifications of their decision-making process. That was one of the reasons. The second reason, I thought it was therapeutic for me to do this, so that I'd have an opportunity to turn post-traumatic stress into post-traumatic strength, if you will. It helped me deal with a lot of issues that have been identified for several years, and that was helpful. And I wanted, also, I think that at this station in life, I'm surprised how much interest there really is in the Vietnam War. And there's a lot of veterans who served in that war at home, retired after long careers and whatever they did and raised a family. And now they've got time to think about what happened to them. And they're dealing with some more complex issues, the issues of traumatic stress that they haven't addressed before. And so we're actually finding, the VA's finding, that there's more and more post-traumatic stress amongst retired soldiers, and they need help. We got to tell our stories to get them that you can survive all of this and find a friend if you can.
Mm-hmm. Why the title, Care Under Fire, and sort of maybe describe the first time you had to give Care Under Fire?
Okay. Well, Care Under Fire is interesting enough as an Army protocol for training medics and how to deal with stress and combat casualties while they're under fire. And so it appropriately fit the job that I had in Vietnam in the 60s. So I think that's why I called it Care Under Fire.
So who did you serve with, and did you have training as a medic before you went in?
Good question, John. I had no training as a medic, and I served with the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One, if you will, pretty well-known division because of the hidden Normandy beach in World War II. But that's who I served with. And I served with the Blue Spader Regiment, 1st Battalion, 26th Infantry. And I was a grunt medic, Company A, was where I spent my year with them in Vietnam. Back in, it was 1967, 68 when I was in Vietnam.
So. Mm-hmm. So what about your first experience in providing care under fire? You mentioned somewhere in there the first was the worst.
Yeah, I think... the first was the worst was a situation where I was pretty new in country, and we were moving out to an ambush patrol. Now, you have to understand that in the Vietnam War, medics were embedded with the infantry for the first time. All the other wars, World War II, World War I, Korea, the medics were really close to the front, but not actually on patrol with the infantry. And in Vietnam, we actually went on patrol every day with the infantry. In fact, I pulled about 200 patrols in my time there, and 60 of those were at night on what's called ambush patrol. This particular night, we were moving into an ambush site, and the platoon leader decided to change the location, go a little further into enemy territory, past the village, knew there was quite a few soldiers, enemy soldiers in that area. Going past this village, we started receiving fire. In fact, the fellow next to me saw a machine gun pointed at us and said, "Hit it, Doc." DOC was our acronym that we call the medics. And we both got down. He was right next to me, about the same distance you and I are now, John, maybe a little closer. And a machine gun burst hit right in front of us, threw dirt in my face and ricocheted over my head, but one of the ricochets caught him and went into his shoulder and into his body. And it was very tough. I ended up laying on top of him and giving him morphine because he kept wanting to get up and run away. He was hurt really bad, and he eventually died that night. And so how to deal with that stress the first time, had been killed in action under my watch, was very traumatic and very difficult. And so that was a very important situation to me, and then that kind of set the stage for a lot of things to follow. I felt pretty sad about losing him. In fact, had to have a platoon sergeant talk to me eventually because I was moping around and not focusing. And he said, "Look, you just got to deal with this situation. This is the first one for you. You're going to have more." He says, "Just get over it, or you're not going to be worth a damn to the rest of your soldiers. So, suck it up and move forward." And that's what I did. And that advice stuck with me the rest of my life.
Wow. Well, you have a chapter in here about race relations in Vietnam. What lessons do you think society today might take away from your experiences with African-American soldiers?
Good question. The military hadn't been integrated that long at that particular point in time, and I was in the military in 1967 through 1969, and those were turbulent times back in our country. With a lot of civil unrest going on and a lot of difficulties in between the races, certainly. And those things were transparent in the military to some extent as well. But when I got to an infantry unit, I replaced, in my platoon, I started out as a platoon medic, I replaced a black medic and who knew the soldiers well and what have you. And as tough as it was in those days, the blacks were uncertain as to whether they could trust a white medic. I had no idea that that would be an issue. It wasn't to me, but it certainly was to them. And so we learned, but we had each other's back. And the first casualty I dealt with was a white guy. And no problem, took care of him, did my thing. But the next casualty actually was a black guy. And the blacks were talking about it amongst themselves, and I was told that they were suspect of whether I would treat a black the same as I treated the white. A lot of these fellows were from the South, and times where life was difficult for them in a non-military manner. And I did. I took care of him. I went out to the point and brought him back and took care of his injuries and stuff and evacuated him. And later on, the black soldiers all appreciated that I did that, that I wouldn't treat them any differently. And I said, "I've got your back. You've got mine. That's what it's all about. We all bleed red." That was important. So we always had nicknames for people. I was Doc or Polak because Straczynski is difficult for people to say, particularly if you haven't seen many Polaks in your life from the South and you're from the South. In any event, they started calling me Solak after that, and that name stuck with me in the Army, and I liked it. I enjoyed it. But it really talked about the bond that existed between soldiers. We didn't look at each other's color of our skin. You had black sergeants. You had white sergeants. We just trusted each other, and we dug foxholes together, and we took care of each other. And that sacred bond is very important. And it always amazed me that society couldn't figure out how to get along. We got along in a combat zone, and I was there when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and we talked about it, the blacks and the whites, about who he was and what have you. So I just was really perplexed by the society when I got back to the United States, how divided we were as a country, and perhaps we still are. But that's what I learned, and I thought it was remarkable, and that bond exists to this day.
Well, from your descriptions of a family in the book, clearly family is important to you. Can you share the advice you got from your family before you joined the Army?
Yeah, happy to. It was pretty simple. First of all, my dad and many of my uncles served in World War II. I'm of that generation. A baby boomer, if you will. And so it was not a big deal to me when I got drafted. I didn't think about going to Canada or anything else, just going in the service. But my dad, when he took me down to the armory to go in, take my physical and to leave for boot camp, he said, "Bill, I want to tell you one thing." He says, "First of all, when you're in the Army, just keep your mouth shut and do what you're told." that was the practical advice he gave me. And you know, it was remarkable. That was the best advice he could possibly give, because that's what I did. And I survived the Army just fine and all those protocols.
Mm. Well, you mentioned already that medics are unique and special people in units. Can you expand more on that?
Yeah, it was really interesting to me. I was 20 years old, and I turned 21 in Vietnam, but I was 20 when I got there. And obviously, we took care of soldiers, their everyday maladies, so I could certify them to go out on patrol today. And took care of them when they got injured. I was right there with them. We'd go on patrols with as few as 10 people, and sometimes we had casualties at night, got in a firefight. But I also carried an M16, and I fired two if I needed to. But they really relied on the medics and trusted us for that emergency health care immediately after upon getting injured. But it was sort of like interesting. People started bringing problems to me, you know, like I was the chaplain. There was no chaplain in the field. And I felt like I was a jungle therapist, if you will. People would talk to me. They got a Dear John letter from home and things. And I was giving marital advice to guys, and I was 20 years old. And frankly, I hadn't even had sexual relations myself at that point. But as you can tell, I'm a talker. And I listened to them, and I told them what they needed. They felt much more comfortable talking to me than they did the first sergeant. Mm-hmm. So that's we were all thanks to all those guys. And that bond solidified during those conversations.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go back. Your journey to writing this book. I understand, I was told, that it started with a speech you gave to emergency health care providers. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. As you know, I've been around the Capitol for a number of years in public policy and government affairs. But I was asked by the Minnesota Ambulance Association to give a speech, be their keynote speaker one time. And I thought they wanted to talk about the legislative process. And they said, no, we heard you were a medic in Vietnam, a combat medic, and we'd like to hear your story. Well, I thought about that for a couple of weeks and before I gave an answer, and I said, well, if anybody would understand what I went through, it would be those people, the EMS. So it was their Stars of Life banquet where they actually give out awards to all the EMTs and medics and paramedics that were throughout the year. And I gave that speech and talked about it because I knew they knew how to make the call under fire, how to deal with stress. You're the person on the job that everybody's looking for you to solve that problem. That's a lot of pressure, and you're dealing with life and death situations. And so I gave my speech. I got a standing ovation. I was very humbled by that, and everybody shouted, "Welcome home." And that felt really special to me, and it really did, and I'm glad I did it. And that was an incentive for me, since I had written a speech, to just continue telling my stories.
Bill, when you returned from Vietnam, how did your experiences there influence sort of the decisions you made throughout your life? You mentioned a little bit about it, but...
Yeah, there were a couple of things. First of all, one time we were in Vietnam, and I was we were out in the field for 119 days, and they called the entire brigade out of the field from our 1st Division and brought us in out of the field to a base camp to pack our equipment and get up on the tarmac, which is the runway. And we sat in that tarmac all night long, not knowing why. We were just, the whole brigade was up there. And the next morning, we stood down and went back out in the field again. And I asked the first sergeant, what was that all about? And he said, well, they captured some ship called the Pueblo, took it from the Navy, and it's in North Korean harbor. And we're getting ready to move all of you guys into North Korea for a combat operation. And so I was perplexed by that, certainly. And I went to Japan in R&R, and I looked up an old friend of mine who was an Air Force controller, as it turns out. And I told him my story. And he says, well, let me tell you my story, he said. I was in the tower that day, and he said, we knew the Pueblo was a spy ship, and we knew they were in international waters, but the North Koreans came out with their gunboats to seize it. We had airplanes over the Pueblo, but they were all loaded with nuclear bombs. Nobody had a conventional 500-pound bomb amongst them. We brought them all back, rearmed them, and sent them back out with conventional bombs instead of nuclear, tactical nuclear bombs. That was really overwhelming to me, and that was one of them. And the other one was that the government just couldn't agree to the shape of the conference table. We thought there was going to be peace treaty, peace discussions, and they couldn't agree to the conference table shape. And so that was very frustrating to all of us who were hoping to go home right away. Hey, peace talks broke out. So I decided at that point that I wanted to get involved in government and public policy. I made that decision in Vietnam. I came back and finished my – I had 2 years of college before I went in the service, and I finished it with a degree in political science and got involved in politics and government. I spent many years in state government and then formed my own governmental affairs firm so that I can still be involved with public policy. And I remember when I made that decision back in Vietnam in 1968.
Yeah. You also mentioned about bringing home lessons and applying them, as you're just talking about. But how about decisions and how you react to various situations? Can you tell us about those lessons and the meaning to you?
Yeah. You know, what's was really interesting to me is that the first time you experience combat, it's hard to describe to people, and they can hardly prepare you for your training for that situation. My training was only 10 weeks as a medic. And so now you're in a combat situation, and the adrenaline's rushing, and you got and somebody hollers the word medic. Well, that's when I had to get up from my secure position and go to that person and render care under fire. I was smart. I always took the M60 machine gun operator with me, and he would lay down fire as I took care of business. But eventually, you learn on-the-job training. Again, in 10 weeks, you can't train people for that circumstance. But you eventually learn how to keep your adrenaline under control, and you learn how to take care of business as you're supposed to and move forward. Now, and you tend to stay relaxed. You don't panic anymore at this point after some further experiences. Now, when you come back, I've never met a problem that I didn't think I could solve. I've always stayed calm. I've never let things get to me in my professional life or in family life. You just stay calm under fire and you realize that you can do, you can handle this. You know, you have that inner confidence. And I was blessed, perhaps, to have learned that lesson in Vietnam that I applied the rest of my life. And I encourage a lot of people, and young people particularly, to take advantage of those experiences.
In your efforts as a lobbyist, you actually worked on getting money for public television documentaries in Minnesota about Vietnam. You know, how did the fundraising work help shape your decision maybe to tell your story?
Well, I worked with the Minnesota Public Television Association, and we certainly had an initiative called Minnesota Remembers Vietnam in concert and companionship with the Ken Burns series that aired a couple of years ago. But it required some legislative funding to get started. So we were I was the lead lobbyist in that effort, and we I did a lot of presentations before committees, and I started telling my story to legislative committees and realized that there was just genuine interest in there, interest that there hasn't been for years, that they really wanted to hear about Vietnam and individual stories. So I went through that process. Our efforts were successful, and then I worked with public television during that next year to provide some insights and to gather some folks together to talk more about their experiences. So that was another catalyst that was really important for me to get the word out and to talk about my story.
Well, Bill, what's the most important lesson or idea that you hope people would take away from reading this book?
Well, I think the most important lesson to learn is that we're all resilient. And even at 18 or 19 or 20 years old, 19 was the average age of a soldier in Vietnam, they're resilient and they can do more than they think they can. There's no turning back. You can do that. And I think that I advise folks that you really can turn adversity into something positive with the rest of your life. These are really important lessons, and young people should know that it's not hopeless. There's a lot of opportunity out there, and your chance to prove yourself was special in my case.
Yeah. Well, what do you think was the most misunderstood part of the soldier's Vietnam experience then? And then, of course, what do you think the most misunderstood part is today?
Well, I think they're the same, basically. People, when we came back from Vietnam, the protests were in full force. They were throwing eggs at the bus. I had people spit in my face like a lot of soldiers did because we wore uniforms. People were really upset. They weren't upset with the soldiers. We were merely an instrument of our government policy. And so they took out their anger on the soldiers when really they needed to direct their attention to the politicians in Washington, D.C., who sent us there in the first place, made those decisions. And that was wrong. We were just doing what we were asked to do for our country. We're all true patriots in any event, but we just did that. Now, it's interesting. I have had a number of reviews and a number of letters that I received from people who said they were protesters back in the 60s, and I was one of those people who spit at soldiers. But I really regret that part of my life. I now realize, reading your book, that it wasn't, you were just doing what you were asked to do on behalf of all of us, our country. It wasn't your fault you were there. And so we had our anger was misplaced. And I've changed my attitude about that, and I regret having that, and I apologize to you at least for my actions as a young person. So I thought it was remarkable.
Yeah. Well, Bill, this question's been asked over the years, but your opinion, your thoughts, was Vietnam War a mistake?
I suspect ultimately, as Ken Burns disclosed in his interviews, that it was long-term. It probably was not the best strategy, but how do you know when things start out, when conflicts, when political decision-making occurs? So it wasn't a mistake to those of us who were there. It was very real, and it was a war. The 1st Division I was with lost more soldiers in Vietnam in 5 years than they did in World War II. Just amazing, because there was always so many different firefights. The average soldier was in about 200 firefights in a year's time if you were with infantry. We learned. The unfortunate thing is we learned, and we kind of figured it out when we were there, that this is an unwinnable war the way they're taking it, the direction they're taking it, and it's not fair to the soldiers and their families and others to follow, that this is the route we have to pursue. So I think from that perspective, probably it was a mistake. But we all learned a lot, hopefully, from those experiences, and we certainly did as individual soldiers in our commitments to our lives. But I have to share with you one quick thing, is that we were told at the time, and here's how it ties together, we were told at the time I had to give 2 years to the Army. That was a lie. I've given the Army over 55 years of my life. These, you develop situations, and you think about things that you can't escape. You. They're with you every day, and I think about them every day. So it's important to understand resilience and how to deal with all of that stuff.
And you talk about that. Of course, a lot has been written, a lot's been talked about the trauma of experiencing combat and post-traumatic stress. You know, how did you deal with this trauma?
Another good question. I think I was certainly an introvert, and I was very secluded when I came back from Vietnam. But when I got back on college life, you start to reach out to others to make social connections. And I joined the Vets Club at Mankato State. Early on, we had our Band of Brothers, which replicated what we had in the service. And we stick together over all these years. I still have breakfast every Saturday with people I went to college with from that Vets Club. That enabled all of us to deal with those situations moving forward. Mm-hmm. And I think people just, if you're having issues, find somebody you can talk to about them. And I had that opportunity.
What's been the reaction to the book so far?
Well, it's the reaction's been very overwhelming. I'm really surprised. There's a lot of renewed interest in what happened with respect to the Vietnam War. I think because people didn't want to talk about it for so many years, they all felt guilty about a lot of things, perhaps. And we all felt the soldiers frustrated about the way things were going.
If people are interested, would like to get a copy of the book, where can they go?
The easiest thing is to go to my website, which is called careunderfire.us, all one word, careunderfire.us. And there's more description of the book and an opportunity to purchase it there, which will take you to a link at Amazon where it's available.
All right. Well, Bill, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was author Bill Straczynski about his memoir, Care Under Fire, about his time serving as a medic during the Vietnam War. He visited with John Harris, host of Prairie Pulse, which airs on Prairie Public's television service Thursdays at 8 p.m. Central. Still to come on Main Street, the latest about the Russian SolarWinds cyber attack. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Minnesota House and Senate are taking different approaches to conducting business during the 2021 legislative session. With the COVID-19 pandemic still a concern, the DFL House will conduct all committee hearings remotely and have only a handful of people at floor sessions. DFL House Speaker Melissa Hortman says her priority is safety.
As we think about members of the House of Representatives coming together from the entire state, it's really, really important that we don't unknowingly bring COVID-19 from the state capitol back to our communities.
The Minnesota Senate will start with a mix of remote and in-person meetings. GOP Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka says his goal is to get all lawmakers back to the capitol later in the session.
We're trying to move as quickly as we can to in-person, or at least the ability to have some people in person, because it is not as effective, it's not as good as in-person meetings.
The session starts next week. After seeing new snow arrive in central North Dakota this morning, it's now time for the eastern third of the state to gain more snow. Jacob Spender is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Grand Forks.
So we'll see a spread of snow coming in from the central portions of North Dakota, and that will head into the Red River Valley, and currently is in some locations just southwest of Grand Forks. And that will continue to spread across our entire forecast area over the next several hours and into the early evening.
Spender says 2 to 4 inches of snow could be seen in most parts of the region, although
the heaviest snowfall totals look to be around the I-94 corridor and point southeast, with isolated areas of potentially reaching 5 inches.
Spender says while the system expands to the east, look for ongoing snow in central North Dakota. And UND has hired a new dean for the Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences. Robert Kraus is currently Associate Dean of Flight and Operations at Kent State University. He says he's excited about the opportunities at UND, and he says one of those opportunities is the expansion of unmanned aerial systems research and development.
Because there's such great support from the state legislature and the governor's office and the entire state as a whole, and then you add on the business side of it, the university is a great partner to all of that, to look at the application side, look at the education side, look at the research side of it, to say where can the university and the community contribute.
Kraus says he's hoping to build upon the school's successes. He starts January 15th. The current dean, Paul Linseth, is returning to his position as a professor in the aviation department. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
You never know what will happen next, nor where you'll be tomorrow when you are traveling in a covered wagon.
In A Tale of Two Lauras, Laura Ingalls Wilder was a real-life pioneer girl who grew up to write books about her childhood.
Little House on the Prairie. I had lived it all on the frontier.
How the West was settled.
Enjoy Laura Ingalls Wilder, Prairie to Page.
All I have told is the truth, but not the whole truth.
On American Masters.
Watch American Masters tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Dr. Jeremy Straub. He is an assistant professor of computer science at North Dakota State University, and he joins me to talk about the recent hack that happened and has nationwide and even international ramifications. Jeremy, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
What is the latest that we know about the SolarWinds hack?
Well, there's a lot that is known right now, and there's also a lot that's not known. You know, this hack has been discussed in the media for just over 2 weeks as we record this today. And so there's a lot of, kind of initial knowledge about this and a lot of initial speculation. But probably the biggest thing for everybody to take away from this at this point is that there's a lot more analysis that needs to be done before, the experts can really say conclusively exactly what happened and maybe also more importantly, what didn't happen. So what we know right now is that there has been malware on a service that provides basically software update services to lots of companies and government agencies. And that because that malware was on that service potentially has delivered that malware to quite a number of different places. And we've seen some initial reports of a number of places that have had that malware detected on their systems. But what we haven't seen yet is a whole lot in terms of reporting or announcements in terms of the kind of the specifics of what the implications have been for a lot of these companies or these agencies that have been impacted by it. And it's potentially possible we may see quite a number of other reports, as companies now know that this exists and that they may have been in some way directly or indirectly affected by it, and they check their systems. We may see other reports of, kind of derivative implications of this attack as well.
Why was solar winds specifically targeted in this attack?
Well, you know, anytime you have a system like that that provides services to lots of other systems, it becomes a really good target for an attacker. And you kind of have to think about this from an economic perspective. You know, basically, an attacker has a limited amount of resource that they have to conduct attacks. And in a lot of cases, an attacker is trying to maximize the value of that resource. And so, you know, in the case of a state attacker, that may be achieving particular political ends or particular destabilization ends. And so that attacker is looking for, you know, kind of basically the way to get the biggest bang for their buck in terms of the resource that they have to attack versus, of course, the outcomes of that attacker, or at least the outcomes that they project as being possible of a given attack that they try. And so from that perspective, something like SolarWinds that distributes software to all these different places becomes basically a delivery mechanism for this attack. If you're able to get in, you know, the front door, the back door, the side door to a system like that, that system then can propel your attack basically in the front door of all these other places, just looking like a normal software update.
Right. It's a normal war tactic that you would disrupt a supply chain. And that's essentially what this is, just in a digital space. Is that a fair comparison?
Yeah, I mean, the parallel is not perfect. You know, that term has been used a lot. You know, typically when you're talking about a supply chain in warfare, you're talking about, you know, preventing, you know, troops from getting food or getting ammunition or getting other kind of implements that they use to maintain life or to actually fight the war. The way that this parallels, and the reason that this is a really good kind of conceptual way of thinking about it, is because the, you know, supply of these updates are definitely tools that are used to keep the system secure. So it's not like this is necessarily cut off, you know, power or water or food or something to the, you know, the companies that use SolarWinds. But what it has done is it's impacted their systems that rely upon this software update service. And, you know, potentially even has started to change the way people think about using services like this, you know, and whether they would trust something like this when, you know, now that we know that, you know, a system like this can not only be compromised, but also become a really good, you know, delivery vector. You know, I think everybody that manages IT systems now probably knew this in the back of their mind that something like this was possible because, you know, of course, you know, this is what people in cybersecurity do. We have to think about, you know, what could go wrong. But now that you have this kind of pronounced impact, you know, and seeing the implications and seeing how widely it's spread, and seeing, again, you know, that economic benefit that exists to the attacker from simply saying, you know, this is the way I get the most bang for my attack buck. You know, I think now as an IT manager, you have to really think, well, do I want to use a service like this when a service like this would now seem to be a particularly, you know, ideal target for an attacker? Because, again, they get that secondary and tertiary delivery capability if they get in, you know, get in the front door, the back door, the side door at the software delivery vendor.
Well, and they are providing software to thousands of agencies, some of which are federal. And so there would be some nationwide implications there. I'm curious, do we know, are there any North Dakota specific threats or even possibility of threat, especially as you say, those sort of second and third rounds that are possible now?
Well, and you know, that's a really good question. And I think at this point, you know, we know that there are certainly federal agencies that have nationwide responsibilities. So, you know, they obviously have, you know, implications related to North Dakota. We know that there are some big companies that have been impacted that have, you know, locations potentially in North Dakota or provide services to North Dakota. But what we really haven't seen a lot of yet, and what I think we will very likely see more of, is companies beginning to discuss how this impacted their systems. Because right now, most of what we've heard about and what we've been talking about has been about this kind of primary breach, about how they got in the door and then this software was distributed onwards. And the question now for every company that was potentially exposed to this update that had this malicious code in it is, did this actually compromise their systems, or was it caught before it could do that? And, you know, certainly Microsoft took some pretty aggressive action to try to minimize the damage of this once it was known, removing some of the certificates that the update mechanism relies upon, and that this code was signed with, to try to prevent it from getting onward installed once it was known, and a few other things like that. So there has been some pretty specific activities to try to prevent this from spreading more than it already has. But you know, anytime you have a system that potentially could be compromised, you really need to do the analysis to figure out if it has been compromised and what was actually compromised from it. And that's the process that's going to take some time now. And you know, in this way, this is a little bit different than a lot of the breach notifications that as consumers we hear about so frequently. Because normally when we're hearing about a breach notification as a consumer, we're hearing about something that's been researched. We're hearing about something where the company has analyzed what the attackers have done. They're talking about what information they think the attackers may or may not have had access to, what information the attackers may or may not have taken away, because they've had a chance to go through their own records. And in some cases, they don't have all the answers. In some cases, there is ambiguity there. But what we're hearing about right now is basically the entity before that saying, well, there's an attack, and this attack has potentially affected, all of these kind of entry points to all of these other entities. And now all of these other entities have to do this analysis and figure out whether or not their system was compromised, figure out what the implications of that compromise are, and then, if necessary, notify their customers. And so we're hearing about this again as kind of consumers much earlier in the process than we typically would. So we don't have a lot of the answers that we typically would expect to have with a public breach notification. Because again, from a consumer perspective, most of us, if we are affected by this, won't be affected by this kind of primary attack, but by the secondary and tertiary attacks that it enables, if those are present.
And those could be what, months, years in the future? Do we even know the answer to that?
Well, and that's a great question. And what we don't know right now is how active this is. Certainly the actions that Microsoft took to prevent the updates from being, it's further installed will prevent the spread, but it wouldn't necessarily prevent or stop a system that has already been compromised, particularly if the attacker has already used that foothold on the system to make some sort of a change or give themselves an alternate credential. And so there's a few different things that we have to look at here. The first is, what maybe has already happened to date. So, as we're sitting here today, has there been information that has been compromised, that's been exfiltrated, that's maybe even been used in some way to compromise another system? And then the second thing is, are there systems that are still actively accessible by the attackers, either that they're, that they're continuing to attack now, or where they have the access mechanism, but they haven't used it yet? And that really kind of brings us to the third thing, which is, if there are systems that are still accessible to the attackers, what might they do with that access in the future? And so we really kind of have three different timescales, what's happened before, what's happening now, and what potentially could still be enabled by this in the future. And again, I don't think we really have a good answer to the question of any of those timescales, particularly as it relates to the secondary and kind of tertiary attacks that are possible. We know a certain amount about the primary attack now from the breach notification that was provided, but I think we'll hear a lot more about the secondary and tertiary implications of this, even if it's companies saying, we've investigated this and, we had this minor intrusion, but this is how it was capped. And that's kind of the ideal, is that another system or process detected this. And even though, the secondary or tertiary entity was potentially exposed to this malware, that something else actually prevented it from being particularly effective. The worst case scenario is that the attacker actually has used that foothold, gotten a bigger foothold, and it's not detected for some period of time. And, if you think back to the Office of Personnel Management breach, one of the things that's quite interesting, if you read through the congressional report on that, is how there were kind of phases of them understanding more and more about exactly how far in the attackers in the OPM breach actually were, with each time it expanding what they thought that they might have had access to, how long they thought they had access to it. And, certainly in a case like this where you have so many different potentially affected entities, it's very possible we may be hearing about implications of this for years to come. Though, again, ideally, hopefully lots of other systems and processes that companies have in place to protect their network and to protect their computer systems were able to step in and to catch this and to prevent it from doing some of the stuff that it would have tried to do.
But it did go undetected for upwards of 9 months.
Well, and that's the challenge, you know, and so when you have a, you know, a system like this, and, you know, I think we're going to hear a lot of different time scales about this as we know more and more about the specific timing of the attack. You know, we know certain things now that have been, you know, maybe not conclusively determined, but at least our current understanding of this, you know, like we saw with the OPM breach, it may be that there was actually something before what we actually think is the beginning of the attack at present. You know, as I mentioned a minute ago, it's very possible that we may hear about kind of subsequent attacks or attacks that are enabled by this attack, whether it's because they get a foothold through this attack or because they get data and they're able to use that data as part of another attack. And, you know, again, that's really the challenge with something this big, is it really is difficult to fully understand or quantify exactly what the implications are of it until you've had a lot of time to analyze it. And of course, you know, the attacker, you know, presumably probably has a better idea of what the implications are and is able to leverage that understanding to be potentially, you know, conducting attacks, doing nefarious things in this intervening time where those that have been attacked are still just trying to get their head around exactly what the implications of the attack are. Mm-hmm. So it's a very challenging situation.
We're visiting with Jeremy Straub with NDSU's Institute for Cybersecurity Education and Research. And Jeremy, a couple of minutes ago, you said, you know, the worst case scenario, and then you just used the term nefarious, that people are going to do this, of course, for ill-gotten gains. And I hate to ask a question like this because I feel very strongly that the media should not be alarmist. But when you say something like worst case scenario and say that we maybe don't know how long someone has been compromised or who's been compromised and for how long, but is it possible? Is it likely? Or what would they want to do with this information? Are we talking like taking over banks and shutting down access to online banking? Are we talking something with far more deadly implications?
Well, and that's a really good question. And, you know, it really comes down to the objectives of the attacker and how, whether or not the attacker is able to get the access required to achieve those objectives. And so, you know, when you're talking about a criminal organization, for example, they may have a different type of goal than a state actor. You know, a criminal organization might be looking for you know, a way to you know, get funds from a bank and somehow transfer that into their own account or benefit from that. You know, a state actor potentially could be looking for money as well to fund, you know, their activities, you know, that they may need to fund and may not have other funding sources for. But state actors, as well as a number of other types of attackers that, you know, that we talk about in the realm of cybersecurity, like what are called hacktivists, which are hackers that attack for activist purposes. You know, these other types of attackers in some cases are not necessarily trying to, you know, impact a bank as much as they might be trying to instill fear of something like that being possible. Or in some cases, even having the question of, well, what could happen? You know, does this attacker have the capability of impairing the power grid or the water supply or whatever else it may be? And that question mark can be as, you know, powerful of an attack for an attacker that is trying to, you know, kind of sow the seeds of concern as an actual attack could be. You know, once an attack occurs and, you know, it's done and we kind of understand it, we can assess what the damage is and we can say, well, this is what was impacted. You know, this is how we fix it. This is how we roll it back. But when you have a scenario where you don't really understand exactly what's been compromised, the extent to what it's been compromised, you know, there's a lot of potential for concern there. And, you know, I think that the biggest thing really, the biggest thing that somebody listening to this program should take away from this is, you know, this is concerning, right? This is something that as a, you know, an entity, you know, that makes software, that tests software, you know, these are the things that these companies should be really concerned about, is preventing stuff like that. But the other aspect of this is that a good system or a good architecture of a network actually has mechanisms in place to be have different levels of defense against things like this. So a good system is not going to have just one mechanism where somebody can, you know, come in and kind of get control over everything. And so, you know, when we're talking about cybersecurity, when we're teaching students how to implement cybersecurity, we're talking about concepts like defense in depth, about having a diversity of different vendors that are used for different systems. And the reason that we talk about this type of stuff is for exactly this type of incident, where by having different vendors that are operating different systems, even if one vendor is compromised, even if, you know, you have one type of firewall that becomes susceptible or one type of file server that gets infected, you know, having these other systems in place that are not susceptible because they have a different supply chain mechanism is really kind of the key to making it so something like this, well, you know, certainly very undesirable, perhaps isn't as catastrophic as it could be if you had only a single vendor. And, you know, there's a lot of companies out there that are making, you know, given the constraints, given the fact that there are a lot of things that need to be done to make software more secure generally, they're still making good decisions with the tools that they have to work with. And they're implementing, you know, vendor diversity, they're implementing defense in depth to try to mitigate the potential of something like this from causing, you know, catastrophic impact. And so, you know, right now that's the state of the art. That's what companies need to do to be implementing, to be as safe as they can be, you know, using trusted vendors, making sure that they are implementing different systems from different vendors with similar or overlapping responsibilities, and then just doing as much as they can to keep those systems up to date, which is, of course, somewhat ironic in this case because it's actually that last point that, you know, is actually kind of the source of the compromise here. But nonetheless, that's still important to do, even given the current situation.
So how do you tackle this to your students from an ethical perspective? Because as you're teaching students, you're giving them the tools, and the tools are neither good nor bad. It's how they're used.
Well, and that's a really good question. And, you know, certainly that's something that we do spend some time talking about, and that's a really kind of important point. And, you know, there's two aspects to it. There's a, you know, a general ethical discussion about, you know, what exactly is, what is right, what is wrong to be doing here. And then there's also a discussion of, you know, where the law stands on this. And it's really important that when students are learning the tools to attack, the tools to defend, that they're also learning how they are, you know, appropriately used and what the consequences are for their misuse. And, you know, it's really important that cybersecurity professionals understand what attackers do, because the way that you prevent attacks is by thinking like an attacker and by being able to kind of anticipate what an attacker might do and set up your systems either to defend against it or, like I was talking about, you know, a few minutes ago, to be robust against it because they have, you know, multiple systems that have shared responsibilities, and a single breach or a single failure doesn't result in the failure of a critical system. And all of that, you know, does require knowledge of how attackers think, what attackers do, and, you know, an understanding of, you know, kind of what the state of the art is for the attacker to make sure that the defenses and the system architecture is up to responding to it. So it's a very, very important and a really kind of big question that that everybody has to deal with.
Dr. Jeremy Straub is the Associate Director for the Institute for Cybersecurity Education and Research at NDSU, where he is also an Assistant Professor of Computer Science. Jeremy, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, great. Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Join Prairie Public Thursday, January 21st for a premier online screening and panel discussion of Esta es mi casa, This is My Home, Prairie Public's original documentary about the journeys of the Red River Valley's Hispanic communities. Generations ago, they came to help with the harvest. Today, their children and grandchildren contribute their own cultural stamp to our region's art, cuisine, diversity, and economy. That's Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Central. Please RSVP for this online event at prairiepublic.org.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 29th. Travel in Dakota Territory was not for the faint of heart. People who came out with wagon trains often walked beside their wagons. Métis traders relied on their two-wheeled Red River carts. Fur traders and mountain men walked and canoed from one end of the territory to the other. On this date in 1905, The Washburn Leader reminded readers of another early form of transportation, the stagecoach. Stagecoach routes crisscrossed the territory until the railroad arrived and the stagecoach faded away. According to the article, stagecoaches carried passengers and mail beginning in 1868. From 1877 to 1880, a booming stagecoach trade carried travelers to the goldfields of the Black Hills. The route from Bismarck to Deadwood was the most popular, as it was the most direct. Since there were no towns along the way, stations were established every 20 miles. Passengers could stretch their legs, while a team of fresh horses was harnessed to the stagecoach. Two famous businessmen with North Dakota ties were involved with the stagecoach business. William Fargo teamed with Henry Wells to form the Wells Fargo Stagecoach Line. They used Concord coaches, recognized as being top of the line and the most comfortable. The Marquis de Moores ran the Medora Stage Company, which ran between Medora and Deadwood. The journey took 36 hours. Today, it takes about 4.5 hours. The cost for a one-way ticket was $21.50, about 10 cents a mile. The most famous stagecoach was the Deadwood Stage. It often carried gold from the Black Hills. It was attacked by desperados with names like Pegleg Bradley and Dunk Blackbird. It was guarded by men with reputations nearly as bad as the highwaymen. On one occasion, it was driven by Calamity Jane. It was eventually purchased by Buffalo Bill Cody, who used one of its coaches as a centerpiece of his Wild West show. Audiences thrilled to the reenactment of outlaws galloping after the fleeing stagecoach. A few historic sites remain today for those who care to look. Bits and pieces of the Abercrombie Trail between St. Paul and Fort Abercrombie can still be found. The Cannonball Station was the fifth stop between Bismarck and Deadwood. Today, it's a historic site, with a water fountain and a picnic table offering hospitality for adventurous travelers looking for history. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
There's a lot of misinformation about the coronavirus.
Yes, I think it was deliberately released by China.
The election.
I can't see how anybody is not thoroughly convinced that Biden was illegally elected.
A new NPR Ipsos poll finds conspiracy theories of all kinds becoming more mainstream in American life. On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Tom Brosseau is the host of the Great American Folk Show, which airs this coming Sunday on Prairie Public, and we'll get a preview of what to expect. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.